What's going on, my podcast family? Welcome back to another episode of Knowing is Knowing. I'm your host, Rashad Young, and as always, I appreciate you guys tuning in to another episode. This episode is super important to me, not only because it is Mental Health Awareness Month, but I also think that connecting mental health professionals is really important, not only for myself, but those who may also may be in need. Therapy and mental health is something that often is talked about in today's time, but how we navigate those spaces, I think it's always important to bring mental health professionals in the space for that. So today I have a special guest, Dr. Powell, who is a therapist, who is an author, a college professor, does so many great things in the space of mental health, and really get a chance to not only understand her story, but to navigate mental health itself. And also, always my favorite topic is to discuss relationships, building healthy relationships, and navigating from a sense of being a Black woman in particular. I think it's really important to navigate as well. So make sure, if you haven't already, to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite audio platform, and more importantly, check out her stuff. Her information will be in the link description below. Thank you again, Dr. Powell, and for those listening, I appreciate you guys. Till next time, peace.
I was excited because this conversation can go so many different ways.
Which who knows? Let's go on an adventure today.
It's an adventure. So, Dr. Powell, I appreciate you joining as everybody I've talked through in this entire process. Again, my ultimate goal is to try to humanize people's stories, right? So when you have these experiences and we hear people with credentials as much as a doctor as yourself, I don't think people understand the journey it takes to get to this point. So my ultimate goal is for us to connect that, but also dive into a lot of good conversations, which sounds like mental health will be that one today. So the question I ask you, like I ask everybody else, is who are you to the world?
All right, that's a great question. So who am I to the world? So I am a daughter, I'm a partner, I'm a therapist, I'm a teacher, I'm an educator, I'm a career counselor of sorts, I'm an advocate, I'm a reader, and I'm also, I would say, an observer. I think of therapy a lot of times as just being a professional people observer, kind of looking at what's happening and making some observations. I think that's really one of the biggest pieces of therapy, or being a good therapist, is having really, really good observational skills. So that's one thing I like to hone on.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing that. So I know, obviously, to get to this point, there's steps. There's several steps that is taken to get into this place. So for you growing up, did you knew that you want to be a therapist? Did you knew you had the skills right away? Like, how did, take me, like, walk me through that. Like, how do we get to this point where we become an educator, a therapist, and other things of that nature?
Yeah, absolutely. So for those that don't know, there's a lot of different paths to become a therapist. There's different disciplines that kind of lead to, like, all roads lead to Rome type of situation when it comes to being a therapist. So there's a counseling route. There's also marriage and family therapy that people can specialize in. There's also psychology that people can specialize in. And then there's social work that people can specialize in. So there's kind of four avenues to become, like, a licensed therapist. And so my avenue was social work. And the way I kind of got introduced to social work was that I kind of got it the family way. My grandmother was actually a social worker in the 50s in the Midwest. Yeah. So that was my first exposure to learning about social work in general and, like, what she was doing. She worked primarily in child welfare and then eventually kind of transitioned into the classroom where she taught social work for a really long time. So that was really my entryway into, like, the therapy, social work, counseling, helping people space overall. Initially, when I grew up, I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be an emergency room physician.
Really?
I did. That was what I wanted to do all the way up until about 18 when I took my first biology class and recognized that there was a lot of information I didn't know, and it was going to be a very long journey of the sciences. And kind of had to make an executive decision at 18. I was like, I think my life needs to go in a different direction because these are a lot of sciences. And my educational journey was a little bit different in that I was actually homeschooled all the way until college. So I didn't have a background in sciences until I got to that college class, and recognizing kind of that gap of, you know, I didn't do high school chemistry, didn't do high school physics, didn't do any sciences whatsoever. And knowing I would have to kind of work backwards and then catch up with all the stuff I'd missed with high school and then go forward with some of the advanced sciences, I kind of decided that the helping field was calling my name and I still could do, still could help people just in a different way than being a medical doctor. So now I'm a, I guess, a PhD doctor, not a medical doctor. So I went a different route with the helping people. But I've always wanted to be a social worker in some way, shape, or form. I think social work isn't always, something that happens within the therapy room. It's something that can happen in so many other different settings. And it's something that, even would help a physician with bedside manner. So that's kind of how I came into it. I made that decision at 18, and then I changed my major to social work and kind of wrote it out. I did my master's in social work as well, and then did some additional work in marriage and family therapy, and then pursued my PhD. So just a whole lot
Which is
of school.
that's in social work too, yeah.
My PhD is actually in social psychology, so
Okay.
I want to do something different. As much as I like social work, I want it because my bachelor's degree and my master's degree was in social work.
This
I
work.
wanted to kind of switch it up a little bit and
Yeah,
kind
of course.
of challenge myself. So I
Yeah.
went into a totally different discipline, social psychology, and so went that route.
Wow. Well, thank you. That's an interesting route. I want to go back to the homeschool aspect.
Absolutely.
How was that experience from birth to 18 and then transitioning to college? Like, how was that transition for you?
So for me, it was really challenging. Because, growing up, there wasn't necessarily the same structure of getting up and going to school every day. While we did have a lot of structure, I am the oldest of four. We're all 2 years apart. My mom homeschooled all of us. It was a totally different schedule, a whole different way of life when it came to college, because I wasn't used to, I think, the structure of a classroom. I didn't have like scheduled tests all through high school. I went to high school basically through the mail because we did a correspondence course that was just accredited. And so all my tests were just mail-in tests. And so getting into a college classroom was a really big change for me, especially as somebody that hadn't lived outside my house until I actually went to college. And having been homeschooled, I'm at home all the time and didn't have a whole lot of interactions with other people my age. So kind of the social aspect was a big piece of that as well. So a whole lot of changes happened once I went to college.
Would you say the biggest adjustment was maybe was it socially? Was that a challenge in that?
I would say, yeah, I definitely think that was a really big piece of that. I think socially in general, because I was homeschooled, I missed out on a whole lot of the typical high school experiences, like the prom and the guidance counselors and the help with the SATs and ACT scholarships and, some of the extracurricular activities. So when I got into college, it really was kind of a, I guess, a mini high school experience in a way, because I went to a smaller college. So I did get, I guess I started from scratch in that way, as far as just making friends and meeting people. And the great thing was that I went to a college where it was really family oriented. It was a super small school, about 1,600 students, which is the
Oh,
size
wow.
of some high schools in the country. But it was a college. So it was also the same college that my parents had went to and my grandparents had went to and some cousins and family members had gone to.
Oh, wow.
So I'm in school with the same teachers my parents had when they were in college. At, classes with my cousins, and it was a fairly smooth transition because I was automatically kind of familiar with, some of the campus and, the activities and just the area.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Well, it was a transition itself. There was some familiarity for making that switch, which is great. I always find it interesting when I do talk to people in the social working space. My mom is actually a social worker.
Oh, cool.
She started off as an adoption specialist, and now she's training and supervising now. So, like, to see that journey, I know how interesting the social worker field is. What do you think is one big misconception about social workers and compared to other mental health professionals?
I think one of the biggest misconceptions is that social workers can't be therapists. It's really surprising, I think a lot of times people are surprised when they find that social workers are therapists, because a lot of times social workers are tied to child welfare as far as the people that take kids away. And that tends to be people's kind of association with social work, even in this day and age, which I totally understand because there's a lot of social workers that do work in child welfare and work with families and connect them to resources. But as far as social workers as therapists, that's still kind of relatively new. I don't know if everybody kind of knows like how much overlap happens with that.
No, I think that's a big thing. I was one of the things I was learning. I was like, oh, wow, you guys are learning the same exact thing. And I honestly would say that sometimes I think social workers could end up being better therapists, especially like with kids, especially just because of the overlap and then also different skills you got to learn working with kids with different backgrounds and stuff like that. Does your population kids like will you tr traditionally work with or
So
do you work?
I have done some training in working with kids because my background is also in marriage and family therapy. When I did my marriage and family therapy classes, I did a whole lot of family work, a lot of work with kids, a lot of work with couples because that was part of my MFT for short work. But now professionally, I work with 18 and over. I like kids, but working with them means working with parents, and parents aren't as easy as kids sometimes, depending on the situation and what's happening.
Yeah, a couple of my clients are kids. Love the parents though, but yeah, that's always the biggest thing when mom have questions and I don't have answers sometimes. They wanna dig in and try to figure it out. And I think working with kids, I think maybe because I do enjoy it. I do also understand the complexities behind just the parental piece. Cause again, it's like they're coming to you as the expert of their child, but not understanding that, you know, some of their issues and traumas could be connected with the parent. So when
Absolutely.
they have certain questions, sometimes I'm like, low key, mom, you kind of are part of the
Yeah, there's a
problem.
lot of times some connection between the, what's happening with the child and what's happening with the parent. And untangling that takes, I think, a lot of expertise, but also kind of some sensitivity as well, because you don't want to shame the parent, but you also want to like empower the parent and also support, the whole system, at the same time.
Yeah, and so transition to therapy yourself since you are professional. I'm getting to the next step. I think there's been a shift in regards to people seeking out mental health services. I think a long time ago, we can say within Black culture, traditionally, our way of getting help was just to pray about it and then just kind of go about it, depending on how we raised. I think within this generation, people are seeking more therapy, but I still think there's a hesitation in the space because they don't necessarily know what they're getting into. So from your perspective, why would you say that therapy would be beneficial for somebody?
Well, I will say that I don't think therapy is necessarily for everybody at every time. I think that there's a lot of situations where therapy is helpful, but it isn't necessarily like a one size fits all or like everybody in life needs therapy. I think that there's a lot of things we can do that are therapeutic that aren't necessarily therapy. And I think that people need things that are therapeutic, and it doesn't always have to include therapy. But it's one of the many tools that we have available when it comes to just support and also feeling heard that I think is really valuable. One thing that I'm noticing is that a lot of times people come to therapy because they need a friend. They need somebody to talk to. They need somebody to bounce ideas off of. And while that can be a use of therapy, it's not always the best use of time, I think, if you have friends in your life that are supportive and listen to you. So if you don't have friends, therapy can be a great way to just, bounce ideas off of someone. But if you have really solid people in your life that you trust, that support you, that you can reach out to, you may not need therapy in the same way as somebody who doesn't have those supports or those resources or those people in their lives.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very valid point. I tell folks all the time, you know, therapy may not be beneficial to you, but never is it my job or anybody else's job in the space to try to convince you to go to it. It is something that you have to have an interest in, and also know that it does take time. I think the biggest thing folks think they go in there and like this person is going to solve my deepest, darkest problems in a matter of months. It can take somebody years, 2 years, 3 years, because it's just always an evolution. Cycle of learning of itself. And I think I tell people all the time, like it really is up to you and how you go about it, and how honest you are in that space to really like grasp what therapy is meant for you. So obviously mental health is a real big thing, and what you're working with relatively I would say young adults and adults, what all you can share, kind of understand like HIPAA and stuff like that. What would you say is the most common things people do come to you for in regards to therapy?
I will say that lately I've met a lot of people that are coming to therapy for the first time. I know you talked a little bit about kind of mental health in the Black community and how there's still a stigma surrounding mental health. I am starting to see more people that are coming to therapy. They may not necessarily have a goal. They may not know what they want to get out of therapy, but they're in therapy because they heard that therapy is a good thing to do. So here they are in front of me, kind of sharing, I'm here because therapy is a good thing to do. So, starting from that point, kind of mapping out some goals and going from that point, I think this can be really helpful. I've noticed that a lot of times people don't necessarily go to therapy because they feel ashamed because they don't want to necessarily like share their deepest, darkest secrets with a stranger. And I totally get that because it is kind of weird, especially if you're doing telehealth or talking to somebody over a screen, to start
Yes.
sharing really deep personal information. I think sometimes that's a little bit easier if you're in an in-person format and you're sitting in an office space with tissues right there. It can sometimes feel maybe a little bit more secure versus facing like a laptop or a camera on your phone and then telling a stranger, hey, this is what's happening in my life. So I think
Sure.
also the setting matters. And sometimes people are more comfortable in different settings and people have different expectations for therapy at the same time. So really, I think that the best way is really to explore their expectations of what therapy is. And then I like to try to provide some psychoeducation around what therapy is and, what it isn't, kind of sharing, there really isn't a magic wand. You're doing
Yeah.
work here, this is 1 hour out of all the hours in the week of your life. And so this hour can be life-changing or it can be just one of the many hours in your week. So how that is used is really up to you. So I really
Yes.
like to take more of a collaborative approach with clients because I think it's important for them to be the experts of their own experience. So with that, I really focus on joining, but also trying to make sure that the goals we're working on is something that they're very invested in. Because if it's my goal, it doesn't make any sense. If it's their
Yeah.
goal, they're going to be more invested in that. So I really want to make sure we're nailing down, what they're seeing as success or what they define as successful when it comes to their therapy experience.
Yeah, no, collaboration is very important. I would say it's probably the, one of the frameworks on making a successful client therapist relationship. From your perspective, what do you say are some good traits for a therapist to be successful in this space?
I would say first and foremost, flexibility. Working with people isn't an exact science as much as we want it to be. Yes, we have textbooks. Yes, we have theories. Yes, we have a lot of resources that help us better understand people, but each person is so different that it really can't be a one size fits all approach. You can't really use the same intervention with every single person because people are different and they have different, thoughts and perspectives and journeys. So, the more flexible you can be as a therapist, I think the better because it's better with meeting people where they are versus trying to pull them to where you are. So I think that's really important. I also think being neutral is super important as a therapist. I think that line is sometimes does get blurred when it comes to being a therapist, but I think overall the goal really is to be neutral because when I think about like good therapy or therapy that is effective, it's really when the therapist is neutral and is acting kind of as a mirror. So you're not saying things one way or the other, you're just reflecting what the client is saying. You're being neutral so that they can come to their own answers and come to their own conclusions without your interference, but the questions that you're asking are actually kind of acting as a reflector. So they see themselves as you're being neutral. So you're just being a mirror to what you're noticing and making some observations in a way that kind of guides the client to the answers that they're looking for.
Yeah, no, I think that's the mirror especially. That's the biggest thing. So it was funny at first when I first got into it and I started like really actively working with clients. The therapeutic silence was very hard for me at first.
Oh, yes.
And it's something I've gotten better with, and it's something I feel like I practice too much now. But I remember the first couple of times when the client would just look at me like, "You don't have nothing to." I'm like, "No, I'm just taking in what you're saying and trying to help you navigate and guide through that." So I would say from your perspective, working in the industry you've done now, what would you say kind of keeps you going in this space? I think with working in the space of service or social services, burnout is relatively high. Turnover is relatively high. And obviously when you're working with people and their problems, sometimes it's hard to navigate the other way. So how do you find ways to stay balanced in this space?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, my dissertation was on work-life balance and married Black women, so I did get a chance to
Oh, okay.
some work on the research side of work-life balance and ways to prevent, burnout when it came to, kind of the burden that women have of, managing competing priorities and oftentimes, having a family, having kids, and then balancing some type of career, whether it's social work or counseling or therapy. So I did get a chance to do some research in that way. When it comes to my life and how I kind of actively prevent burnout or try to like reduce burnout, for me, it's helpful to have other things outside of therapy that I enjoy doing. So for instance, One thing that I do in addition to private practice and seeing clients is that I also work in higher education as a professor. So I get a chance to apply some of the skills I'm talking about with clients in session to my work with students. So, the grading papers and talking about different therapeutic techniques and, giving observational feedback when students are doing role plays of therapy and saying, hey, did you notice this? This is a reflection here. And kind of, I think marrying kind of the clinical work with the education work has been a really good balance for me. Because I think if I did like solely therapy, it'd be really tough. But the fact that I kind of balance it out a little bit with some of the clinical work, but also the education work, I found that that's a good balance for me when it comes to not feeling burned out with either, kind of a both instead of either or.
I was told by a professor not too long ago, if you do private practice and you see like more than six clients a day, like the it was a weird statistic. Like you're leading yourself to burn out a lot quicker. So I'm assuming that your professor working with counselors or counselors in training.
Yep, I work with social workers, but also counseling psychology students. So social workers and both on the on those two fronts and those two disciplines.
You mentioned marriage in your dissertation. What would you say, especially in this space, has been a good tool for you to help navigate that within your own life? I think sometimes in the space of dating or marriage, like when you are a therapist and you're studying human behavior, it's very hard to like turn your brain off when you're recognizing other patterns and behaviors, maybe within your partner, within family and things like that. So how do you find that balance in that space?
Yeah, I think that's a good question because you're right. It is hard to turn your brain off because if
Very
you're a
hard.
therapist and you're dating as a therapist, you're going to be asking different questions than maybe somebody who isn't a therapist because you're probably thinking about family of origin. You're thinking about, all right, their attachment style and
Everything.
their family dynamics and things like that. For me, when I was single, I found it helpful just to turn it all off and just talk to the person. If I'm not on the clock, I'm not going to be assessing you. I'm on the clock. I just want to, have that genuine connection and get to know someone. And I think a lot of that information just kind of comes organically. And if you ask too many questions, it seems more like an interrogation. And that doesn't really work well in the date context. I like to tell my students, if you ask three questions in a row, it feels like an interrogation. And if you make three statements in a row, it sounds like a lecture. So trying to balance out the
That's good.
questions and the statements, even in like a dating context, I think is so helpful with just starting off on, hopefully like the right foot, but also establishing some of those healthy communication patterns early on so that you really can assess for compatibility. Is this someone that I can see myself with long term and really, kind of approach things a bit more systematically than like emotionally?
No, that make I actually like that. Three questions interrogating, three statements is lecturing. I'm putting that in my notes. That's good. Because sometimes I'm like in that in between. It's like I'm either asking too much of a deep, profound question, and they're like, "What are you talking about?" Or I'm making a statement, and then I'm getting the same response. So I know you mentioned in between your transition from now when you first started to now you did work in marriage and family therapy. Did you see couples at that time?
So I've started seeing couples back in 2011. So I've seen couples since then. I
Okay.
started out super new. Came right out of grad school. I actually started seeing couples in graduate school. So had no sales whatsoever, had never been in a relationship myself. But here I am doing like couples therapy and trying to help people navigate the ups and downs of their relationship. So I really did get a chance to learn a lot from the therapy lens about relationships. That really helped me in my relationship eventually down the road. But it definitely was, it's a different dynamic when you have two people in a therapy room together that are trying to figure out their relationship because we have two, a lot of times, different sets of ideas and perspectives. And we're trying to kind of combine those two in a way that makes sense for the couple and for their relationship. So a lot of it is about, negotiation and accepting influence from each other, but also, I really focus on slowing down the sessions so that couples can really hear what the other person's saying. Because a lot of times in relationships, you get so used to hearing the other person's voice that you kind of tune them out after a while. And when you tune them out and they're feeling unheard, and that you tend to feel unheard a lot of times too, and that dynamic can sometimes really start to, lead to some resentment on in one or both partners. So really kind of helping them bring down some of those barriers and really opening I guess opening the gate for more honest dialogue, but also being in a space where they both feel comfortable sharing, this is where I'm at and this is why.
Yeah, no, that is at least my next like string of questions I have, 'cause I'm
Yeah.
always intrigued when people are in this space. From your perspective, what do you think are some keys to a healthy relationship?
So I would say number one is, as cliche as it sounds, is compatibility. I think a lot of times people get together and they really aren't compatible when it comes to like direction. They may like certain things about a person. They may like spending time with them. They may like the same movies or maybe binge watch the same shows. But when it comes to life direction, they could be going in two totally
Two
different
different
directions and they still move forward and get married and then try to figure out what it looks like
ones.
to try to come together when they're going in two different life directions. So I think compatibility is number one, probably one of the biggest things as far as, being with somebody who has similar values as you, who has maybe a similar philosophy of happiness as you. Like, what do you need to be happy? And if the person that you're with has a whole different philosophy of happiness, you're going to be in conflict with them because you're both are going to be fighting for your version of happy, and it's not going to like be the same thing. So that compatibility piece, but also complementarity is really important too, because sameness, gets boring, and the differences is really where the chemistry comes in. And so there's a saying that says opposites attract, but then opposites attack at the same time. So finding that sweet spot of, compatibility, but then also complementarity, so that there's enough chemistry, so that there's passion, there's chemistry, but there's enough sameness with the values and the shared philosophies that make sense moving forward. So finding that sweet spot of those two things, I think, would be probably the most important thing.
You just start, you struck a chord, because I always have this discord with my friends. And you mentioned passion. My viewpoint with love is a little bit intriguing, because I understand it's different for everybody. I think a lot of people are looking for like a this like neurotic feeling, like when you first meet somebody. And I'm just a firm believer that love is, it changes, but it's more of like the action, like how do you show up for that person every day versus the feeling. Like I've heard so many times, I miss the feeling that we used to have, and it's like, well, as time goes on, it's like there's, it's hard for you to say that you'll ever get that feeling back that you once had when y'all first met, because so many things make a change. Maybe I've been married, I got kids, and it's like trying to find that sensation back. From your perspective, like how important is that to the successful relationship? Or am I looking at this wrong? Is love more of a feeling, or is it more of an action? Is it both?
Well, I think of love as, honestly, kind of an action, because it's that love and action that really shows that you're putting in the work to be in a relationship. I tell couples about the importance of waking up every day and deciding that you're going to be in a relationship with this person. The contract is renewed every day. You wake up and decide, hey, I'm going to be in a relationship with this person today. And so let me make this person my priority. And so I think it's important to recognize that most long relationships aren't a test of love, they're a test of character. Because when you look at people who have been together for years and years and years, there's times where they didn't love each other. There's times where they didn't like each other. The feelings come and go, the ups and downs of life happens, but it's the character as far as I'm keeping my word to you because I said I'll be with you through thick and thin, so I'm still here. But it doesn't mean that I've loved every moment of it. It doesn't mean that I haven't thought about going elsewhere. It just means that I haven't filed, but I'm still here.
No, that's real. I'm curious from your perspective, do you think there's been a shift in the dating world? I mean, I was working with clients like from like generationally, like I feel hear it all the time. Like I feel like my grandparents' era is so much different from this era. From your perspective, have you noticed like a shift in that? And if so, like what does that shift look like to you?
Yeah, I think the biggest shift I've seen is really the focus on the individual. I work with a lot of clients. I've encountered a lot of people that talk about it, them being in their selfish season, but they're also looking for like a partner in a relationship
Partner.
while being in their selfish season. And those things aren't necessarily compatible with each other, because being in a relationship does require compromise. It requires, not always getting your own way, and also requires being able to accept influence from another person. And so if everything is about you and your happiness and the way the other person makes you feel, then it's going to be a very high bar for somebody to always meet your needs in that way and, make the mark 100% of the time, because you're also dealing with another flawed human who makes mistakes and has their own set of things that they're working through as well. And so I think honesty is really important when people are kind of approaching dating in general, as far as what specifically are you looking for and why? Because if you're just looking for somebody that kind of serves as decoration to your life, you're not going to be asking the questions that would lead to a deeper connection and, maybe even longevity in a relationship. You're not going to get to the roots of what you really need to make that strong foundation of trust and commitment.
And kind of take it a step further, what do you think are things that hinder relationships in today's time?
I would say unspoken expectations. I think that's one of the biggest things. When people are getting into a relationship and talking to each other, I think a lot of times people struggle with being honest with their partner as far as, hey, this is what I like and this is what I don't like, and this is why. One of the exercises I sometimes do with couples is that, when they have a disagreement, or when they have maybe like a kind of a clashing of sorts, they have to share like what's coming up for them as far as why they feel so strongly about, let's say, this issue, maybe parenting, maybe it's like lateness or being on time, why they feel so strongly about that. And I have them tie it to a story in childhood. All right, you feel this way, tie it to a story in childhood and tell us why you feel this way. What happened growing up that made this really important to you? And so that's helpful in just, helping them express their expectations to their partner, but also can build empathy between the partners, because even if you don't necessarily get to a place of agreement, if you can get to a place of understanding, you can start to have more dialogue and more conversations about that compromise that needs to happen.
No, that's a great point. And I want to take another angle with this. So I recently just turned 30 for context. So now I'm starting to feel like that old head that hates the transition of things. I'm a firm believer that I think social media and dating apps in particular have created a large veil of illusion of options. Would you say, from your perspective, that's also creating an illusion when it comes to people in their views on dating?
I think social media definitely plays a role in people's views on dating, just because a lot of times social media, or people that post on social media, really only portray their highlight reel. They don't always show like the ups and downs of relationships or like the not so great moments that you have to work through to make things look so picture perfect. Life isn't always about like endless dates and going places and, doing all the things. Sometimes it's just as simple as, passing the remote to your partner after they've had a long day and watching the show they want to watch, even though you really want to watch something different.
Something else, yeah.
Just, those small things that really add up over time, that really build that trust, that really build that connection between people. And I think social media kind of takes away from that, because it kind of shows a very glossed over highlight reel of relationships and doesn't always show the ups and downs and the conversations you have, like when your phone is down, that are important for your relationship.
No, that's a very valid point. I think, yeah, the highlight reels is always the thing. The conversations I've had, or the things I hear, it's like, well, what I saw here, this is
Yes.
what I want for my life. And I think, to me, that's so unhealthy, because one, it can be edited, it can be altered, and then also we don't know the full story or the full picture behind that person when they made that video. They could actually be feeling very lonely in the inside, but they want other people to feel and see them looking in a different light. So it really it concerns me when I think about just the next generation. Could I work with high school kids by day, especially all boys. So that's just the thing
Wow.
where yeah, it's a great time. It's so when we have those conversations, their view is so augmented because they think being a man is through these things they see on social media, like the money, the accolades, whatever, right? Which is important to them. But the other end too is like dating. It's like, well, all I see here is that, these women are no good. I can't
Yeah.
trust anybody. It's just like this cycle of people hurting each other relatively early, and they have no idea like what exactly real love could and be like. Because you kind of mentioned again the selfish era season. That personally drives me crazy. I understand it. I think it's important that we have those seasons. But I also think people are now standing on two sides of a hill, saying that this is my season, this is who I am, taking as is. And this other side saying the same thing. And like you mentioned, nobody is coming in the middle, which I think creates this just creates this disdain. Because again, I think people crave connection, because that's what everybody wants. Because that's always my argument. People swear they don't need anybody, but yet people are still getting on dating apps. So obviously we're craving something here.
So true.
But besides the point, I was thinking, as far as with you and what you do, what would you say is your ultimate goal with all the things you do right now? Obviously accomplished in the space that you're in, but like, what would you say is like one of your ultimate goals as you continue to navigate?
That's a great question. I really enjoy the work that I do right now with couples and individuals. This is probably my life's work, at least for the most part, as far as something that I enjoy doing and invested a lot of time and energy in my education doing. But I think overall, I'd love to, eventually write some books about it and, eventually kind of grow in other ways. I see this as something that I'll always do, as far as I probably plan to always see clients, at least one or two, even if I don't have a full caseload, just because I like talking to people and hearing their stories and holding space.
Yeah.
But and I may not do that as much as I'm doing now, but I see that always being a part of my life. But I'd love to, move into maybe more of the writing space and do more writing as my time allows.
Okay. And I know you mentioned it a little bit early in the beginning about private practice. People, when they get into the space, that's obviously, I feel like everybody's ultimate goal. Everybody wants their own practice. I know it's not a 1, 2, 3 step process. So from your experience, like, can you express to maybe somebody who has an interest, like, what are some steps they can have, or what are some steps they should take in order to become successful or get into the private practice space itself?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think overall, and one thing I've learned over my time being in private practice is that private practice is a lot more challenging if you're like a new grad right out of graduate school, because a lot of times you don't always know what you don't know in that setting, and you don't always have the same supports as you would have in a grad school setting or an internship, where you can just like reach out and ask questions and be in kind of that learning space. Private practice can sometimes be pretty isolating, especially if you're just starting out and you don't necessarily have a professional network or colleagues that you can bounce ideas off of. So I would recommend it for somebody who has maybe been in the field for a few years and has had that chance to get that support and that supervision kind of in a more structured context, because private practice is kind of free range in a lot of ways, because everything's on you. You're doing the scheduling, you're seeing the clients, you're writing the notes, you're dealing with
Notes.
insurance. It's kind of a one-stop shop for the most part, unless you're delegating, certain tasks and
Task.
responsibilities. So I would say, get 2 or 3 years in your career first, and then maybe transition to private practice, or start out part-time and have a full-time, so that you're able to kind of manage both and then swap over once you feel more comfortable and more ready to make that leap. But in my experience, I didn't start off with private practice. I started out doing travel social work, and I worked in utilization review as well. So I went to different hospitals all over the country and did different 13-week contracts all over the United States. So that's also part of my background and kind of being in case management and healthcare and discharge planning. So I have a lot
Yeah.
of healthcare experience that I bring to my work in private practice.
13 weeks. You just bounce around just from
Yeah,
like state
13
to state.
weeks. Yeah, it's similar to travel nursing. It's travel social work. That was typically the minimum contract, but I did a contract that was 6 months and contracts that were longer, but that was typically the average length was about 13 weeks or so.
And what was like one of the most important things you learned in that experience traveling to all those different places doing the work?
Yeah, I learned how different social work is in different states. I think that a lot of times we can think that social work looks different in different facilities, but it really can vary depending on the state that you're in, depending on the funding of the state that you're in, depending on the politics of the state that you're in. The resources that are available can really vary depending on those aspects. So yeah, it was really eye-opening to see how social work looks in different states and how people use different, EHRs and how professionals from different disciplines interact with each other, because that's also kind of a common thread of healthcare in general, is that you're collaborating with other healthcare professionals when it comes to working with patients and, coordinating discharges.
That makes me think of, and I try not to get political on these podcasts, I understand, but I think there's a growing concern of like just certain basic care needs that are kind of given to those who are under resource. From your perspective, do you kind of see that potentially causing an issue for those who may be looking for mental health services, especially in the special social work, which I'm assuming would probably have grants and funding that could potentially be cut? Like, what do you think that looks like for the landscape of that?
I think we're headed, for a pretty major crisis when it comes to mental health in this country. Just because I think the need for mental health is really increasing when it comes to just resources and creating spaces where people feel comfortable just sharing and talking to a licensed provider. With a lot of the funding cuts that have been coming down the pipeline, especially when it comes to sometimes government jobs and social workers that may work in government settings or work with, veterans or individuals that are connected to government settings. And with some of those job losses, that's also going to mean that people are going to wait longer to get access to a clinician to get a therapy session, which also means that's longer time that, their symptoms aren't addressed or they're not getting, they're not seeing a psychiatrist, they're not getting prescribed medications, they're not getting that frequency and that consistency of treatment that they need. So I think that we're kind of headed for more of a crisis. But I also think that a lot of therapists are also getting more and more burned out. And so a lot of therapists are deciding to leave the profession, which also, is a gap in care too, when therapists are deciding I need to do something different for my own mental health. And they're, pursuing other opportunities.
Yeah, the cycle really does continue. I was told this maybe a couple weeks ago, and I understand like my positioning as a black man in this space. Like I've been told that like I'm a unicorn, sense of just because of the importance of representation. I wanted to kind of transition to that. Why do you think there is such a representation? I would say it's growing, but like a representation issue for those who are trying to look for black counselors in particular. Like, why do you think it's not more of a, especially for data wise, we usually are in like social service settings.
I mean, I think there's a variety of factors that lead to that. I think we are starting to see more and more like minorities and people of color that are going into helping roles. Traditionally and historically, it has been more kind of, more, as I say, more male led. When you think about like psychologists and a lot of the theorists that were creating some of these theories, a lot of them tend to be white males. And that doesn't always translate when it comes to the work in a therapy room because the theories are really designed for individuals that come from a specific background. And, maybe see therapy as more of a luxury versus a necessity. And so if you see therapy as a luxury item, as kind of a concierge service, your approach to therapy is going to be different. Someone who's experiencing symptoms that are interfering with their functioning and they need kind of a space to talk about coping skills and working through some of the trauma that they've experienced. Those are two different therapy experiences. And so I think when it comes to accessibility and when it comes to more minorities in the profession, I think a lot of times the profession isn't always set up to make it a safe space for minorities. I think a lot of times the licensure process can be daunting and it can, be a deterrent to individuals that are pursuing this as a career. But I also think that the licensure process is important because you are working with people, your words do influence them, and it's still a regulated profession. And I don't think we should go unregulated or like have no boundaries or no tests, but I also think that needs to be maybe more supports around that. But additionally, because this field is growing pretty exponentially large, we're also seeing more programs that are online when it comes to schooling and education. And so that online component is totally different than being in a classroom when it comes to learning some of these skills, when it comes to talking to people in therapy and doing a first session. If you don't get that experience in a classroom, the online environment's a totally different experience. And so a lot of times I think people think therapy is one thing, and then they go to school, they do the online thing, they do all the things, and they finally sit down with somebody face to face, and they are blindsided by, oh, this is a lie. Oh, this is a lie. I didn't really expect this. As opposed to if they had a chance to maybe do that in grad school, sit down face to face and have that frequency of, this is what to expect when you graduate, and you'll see more of this, when you're in private practice or when you're working with people outside of the educational realm. I think people have certain sets of expectations, and when they actually start talking to people and recognizing, oh, this is a lot. I'm seeing more and more therapists complain about their clients trauma dumping on them. And for me, that's kind of concerning because if you can't trauma dump in therapy, where can you trauma
Where
dump?
can you trauma
Let's
dump
be
that?
honest.
Sound
If it's
the
not
whole point.
therapy,
Yeah.
what where else can you go if you can't
Right.
trauma dump in therapy? And so,
Yeah.
with clients be more reluctant to do so because more and more therapists are on social media complaining about clients that are trauma dumping on them. I think that
Yeah.
also changes the perception of therapy because clients are now more reluctant to share because they saw a TikTok about a therapist complaining about a client trauma dumping and they don't want to open up and they're more hesitant.
Yeah, I saw stuff like that, and I had to like refresh my feed when I saw that because I understand that the job itself is it can be daunting because again you're waking up every day, your job is essentially to help people, and you have no idea what you're gonna get sometimes. Like you may have a plan, your session goes one way, and then they're coming in with a totally different thing, and you just kind of caught off guard. So no, that is unique, but I don't like the complaining piece in the sense of that is essentially what that is part of the work that we do. We have signed up for it. The licensing piece, I understand because I think about that hill. Yeah, it's definitely a hill, but I also understand that there's a process you have to go through, and that's just kind of how it is until something changes. You just got to kind of respect that process for what it is. But yeah, that when people complain about it, it's like there's so many things we can complain about in the space. Complain about what clients are talking to you about. We probably should have thought that one through before we press send. But I do have a final question for you, like I asked all my guests, and that is, what does it mean to be human to you?
That's a great question. I think for me to be human is to feel. And I think that, when you're feeling, that's when you know you're he that's how you know you're human. When you have your emotions, when you have your ups and downs, it's like the whole idea that the struggle is proof of life. If you're having your ups and downs, you have your good days, your bad days, the struggle is proof of life. And so feeling is, how I know I'm human. Because I think that's, we all have emotions. We all have ways of dealing with ups and downs. And so, emotions don't necessarily have to be in the driver's seat. They can be in the passenger seat, kind of along for the ride. But, feeling is, how I know I'm human.
Feelings are important, as they tell you. Feelings are valid. So no, I
Absolutely.
appreciate you, Dr. Powell, for joining. For those that can find you on social media, where can they find you?
Sure. So they can find me on Threads, Dr. Alicia says, but they can also email me at aliciapowell@gmail.com and they can check out my therapy practice at Amethyst Counseling and Consulting.
Well, Dr. Powell, I appreciate you joining so much. For those who are listening, will be listening, make sure you check out her work. I'm always so grateful for people to join. I had a couple people reach out to me when I put out the invitation for interviews, thinking I was spam at first. I'm like, I'm not a guy that lies. And I've genuinely enjoyed these conversations because I get to connect with somebody and they get to share their story. And for you to be in the same industry that I'm in, it's always good to be able to pick your brain. So thank you for sharing all this wonderful information. Again, make sure to check out her stuff when this episode comes out. This link will be the bio. It's been another episode of Knowing is Knowing. Appreciate you guys. Until next time.